All right. Hi, I am MJ. I'm an alcoholic. Josh, thank you. Thank you for your service, and thank you for that introduction. My sobriety date is April 27th, 2013. I have a sponsor. She has a sponsor. I have sponsees. I help women through this program. I have a home group. I actually have two home groups. I'll talk about that. One is Sober Sisters of Roswell because it's a women's meeting. That's very important to my story. And then all of you know that you have become my home group as well, especially over the last few months, 6 months or so. So I'm really grateful to be here. I will tell you there's a piece in the big book that is just my story, and it's, you know, the bedevilments. I think that's everybody. But for me, you know, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And I could stop there, but then y'all really wouldn't get to know me. So, you know, I'm going to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's been a while since I've, like, talked in front of a bunch of people. I'll talk a little bit about my family of origin, but my story has changed over the years, not because I make stuff up or I'm lying all the time, but because I've started to realize I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. I think my family of origin just happened to, like, grow all the right things in that little petri dish to make my alcoholism flourish. But I don't necessarily blame it on my family anymore. That was one thing that I did all of my life, is I blamed everyone else for my issues. But I was the baby of six in a large Italian Catholic family. And I was 9 years after my closest sibling. So I was kind of an only child in this big family. So already I didn't quite fit in with the rest of my family in some ways. My dad was an alcoholic, but he was, in my life, the lesser of two evils. He was my person. He was a very high-functioning alcoholic, but he would come home every night, and I used to have to count his drinks. That was something my mom had me do. He would drink about seven gin on the rocks every night as soon as he got home. And but again, very high-functioning, like went to work, got up every morning, you know, all the stuff, took care of his family. And my mom was borderline personality disorder. She is diagnosed, although she will tell you she's not. And so she's been on Valium my entire life. So at a pill popper and an alcoholic for parents. So it just lent for chaos, you know. When I look back, I was really a super happy child, like for the most part. I can remember, you know, anybody I met, I never met a stranger. I ran up to them, hugged them, told them I loved them, whether I knew them or not, you know, not much different from now. and, you know, I kind of would go off into that little world and escape, you know. So everything in my life growing up, always the solution was alcohol. It's just how it was. That, you know, my dad drank every night, you know, weddings, funerals, you name it. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You know, you practically put booze in the bottle when you grow up down there. I remember little things like my dad would open his beer and I, like, still to that this day, that sound reminds me. I was little. I was like a toddler, and I'd be like, oh, I need to taste that to make sure it doesn't poison you. You know, I was his beer tester, right? Hello. Little bit of foreshadowing, but Yeah. So, so alcohol was just always around, and we did the whole, you know, they would let me like dip my finger in. We always did that with kids. Like, oh, you want to taste, you know, stick your finger in their drink. And I would be like, oh, I want more. I want more. So that was just always the case. And then, you know, there was lots of chaos in my family. My parents fought all the time. Most of my brothers and sisters were out of the house. My closest sister to me hated me because she was the baby until I came along. So it was just, it was a lot of turmoil. She fought with my parents all the time. It was just, it was crazy. One Thanksgiving, her and my mom got in a fight, and my mom took the electric knife and like swung at her, didn't catch her, but it was just constant chaos. So they were out of the house, and I was a latchkey kid, you know, if my mom wasn't home. My mom didn't work, but she was always shopping or doing whatever. She worked a little part-time job just to do something, so I'd come home and it'd just be on my own. They would go out of town and leave me. It wasn't a big deal back then. My brother lived down the street, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, I really started, you know, my first real, like, drunk that I remember was I was right after eighth grade. It was, like, 13 years old. And I went to my girlfriend's house after. It was first day of summer. And there was a few of us there drinking vodka and orange juice. We were playing quarters with vodka and orange juice. We ran out of orange juice pretty quickly. And so everybody stopped. But I had to keep drinking the bottle of vodka. And I finished this big bottle of vodka at 13 years old. Left my friend there, had put her in the shower because she was, you know, throwing up all over the place. No one was home. I doused myself in perfume and decided to go home. You know, and now I think back, I remember literally like stumbling from walking home from the sidewalk over the grass into the street. Like I was swerving as I was walking home. I just think about people who drove by seeing this little kid thinking, what on earth happened? Anyway, so that was the first time, and I got away with it. I got home. I called one of my friends that I wanted to go have a sleepover with. Her sister, who was older, came and picked me up, took me to their house, and they were a very open family. Like, they would drink with their kids and stuff like that, so they took care of me. I threw up all night. I blacked out at some point. I woke up the next day, and I was like, I got away with this. I'm going to keep doing it. And I did. So that just continued. I mean, that summer was really, you know, I started drinking all the time. My parents had gone out of town. I had some friends over. We had, you know, drank all of my dad's beer. And I have to tell you, like, this is a mixed meeting, so make it what you will. I'm going to do the best to keep it, you know, rated PG. You all have imaginations. My higher power became boys and booze, and they were very much intertwined, right? And so I can replace one for the other very easily. And I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I was either drowning all the arguing and disaster that's going on at the house with booze, or I'm flirting with anybody I can meet just to make me feel better. And so anyway, we drank all of my dad's beer and probably other stuff, but I knew he'd recognize the empty beer shelf. So I called the kid up the street who was 17, and he brought me some beer, and in return ended up getting more of a payment from me that I really wanted to give him. So at 13, I lost my virginity. And at that moment, a lot changed for me. Again, I don't know that this made me an alcoholic. I don't think it did. Alcohol made me do things I wouldn't have normally done. You know, I don't think I would have done that at 13 years old, you know, had I not been putting myself in those situations. But needless to say, it started a whole trajectory for me. My mom read in my diary that I'd lost my virginity, didn't ask me really what had happened. she just assumed that I was a slut and a whore, sent me to confession, sent me to therapy, sent me to group counseling, and that's what I internalized, is this is who I am now. That shame just fueled everything that I did. And so I was like, well, I'm damaged goods, nobody wants me, I'm no good, off to the races. And that's what high school was. It's a miracle I graduated. I was very much, it's funny, I was like friends with everyone. I wasn't popular. I was just friends with everyone. And yet I had like this big rebel thing, you know. I was like, stay away from me. But inside, I was just a scared little kid and never knew that because I started drinking at 13. I didn't realize I had social anxiety or, you know, any of those things. So high school was just a big party. Amazingly, I didn't get involved with drugs. My oldest brother had been arrested for running cocaine across the state lines. So I somehow managed to stay pretty far away from that. There's a little bit of drugs in my story, but that wasn't the whole, you know, the big thing for me. Alcohol was always it. And so, you know, I graduate high school, and for a blink of an eye, I was set to go to Florida State. That's where my dad, his alma mater, that's where he went. And right before graduation, my dad, I was the baby, you know, I don't think he was ready to let me go. And his family kind of gave him some tough love, and he thought that would work on me. And he's like, you know, I don't think you can cut it at Florida State. I think you need to stay at LSU for a semester. And I was devastated, but I didn't say that. Instead, I was like, screw you, I'm out of here. So I didn't even start my first semester. I went out to San Diego. A friend of mine's husband was in the Navy on a submarine for 6 months, so I went and stayed with her. And before I left, the night before I left, oh, there's so many stories. I mean, 18, I was a blackout. You know, we could drink at 18 in Louisiana. Right before I left, we had gone out. I was going to be flying to San Diego. And, of course, pre-partied at a place called the Happy Hour, the Happy Note, which had, like, shag carpet. It was just one of those old seedy bars. Old, like, World War II vets would hang out there until 3 o'clock, and I'd hang out with them. And then the young crowd would come in and pre-party and, you know, stayed there all night, driving home. It's such a miracle I'm alive. I was driving home and going way too fast, couple of S-curves, almost, I actually did hit a street sign, and it hit my windshield, but luckily glanced off. When I looked the next day, had it just been a little farther over, I probably wouldn't be here. Swerved, missed the light pole, made it home. My car was a disaster. I woke up the next morning thinking, that was a bad dream, but I better go look at my car. And it wasn't a bad dream, right? It's a miracle I didn't kill anybody. It's a miracle I'm still alive. Made up some story. A dog ran out in front of my car, towed the car to a dealership, and I got on a plane and went to San Diego. And for those 6 months, I did nothing except drink. I tried to find a job, had a hard time, did like a little marketing thing or whatever, but just drank. And San Diego, it's always sunny in San Diego. For an alcoholic, that is torture. That is absolute torture. I remember like pulling the blinds shut. You know, I just wanted to stay in and drink, and it was so beautiful outside, I would feel so guilty that I would sit inside and drink all day long and all night long. So that happened. 6 months later, I moved back to Baton Rouge, decide I'm going to go to school. I met, gosh, that was when I was 18. Anyway, met my first victim, my first ex-husband. he was a bouncer at a bar, and I had met him. I was still 17. I had a fake ID since I was 14. I was going to bars at 14 on a fake ID. But I had met him on my 18th birthday. The night before, I had gone in with my fake ID, and then the night of my birthday, I was like, I'm 18! And he looked at me like, wait a minute. Anyway, ironically, we got married. I wasn't even 21 yet when we got married. And he was 9 years older, 8 years older than I was. He was finishing up a master's in finance. He didn't drink at all. So that was a really great matchup for me. So we get married. He decided he wanted to get into the FBI, so he became a police officer. I helped him through all that. I was working at a bar. You know, that was my thing. I did a lot of that. I've matched my jobs for a long time to match my drinking. And the food service industry was a great place to go because I worked at wedding facilities and banquet facilities. And at the end of the wedding, if there was, you know, wine left over, you got to get rid of it. So I would literally finish off bottles of wine. Anyway, so he doesn't drink. I do. It doesn't last very long. About a year, and I was like, I got to get out of here. I stuck around for another year because you have to in Louisiana, you know. And I wasn't even quite divorced yet and had gone to Gulf Shores, Alabama for a bachelorette party with some girlfriends and met my second victim. And you know, we met down there, obviously. He just thought he was going to have a nice little tourist fling. And, you know, little did he know, he got the ball and chain for about 10 years. But we met, and our relationship was based on alcohol. And a month after we met, we found out he had cancer. So for me, being this great codependent, I got to put on my superhero cape, swoop in, and take care of him. And it gave me a great excuse to drink. If you had my life, you would drink like I do. You know, I have to go home, take care of my boyfriend who I just met. He's my soulmate, and we're devastated. He might be dying from cancer, and, you know. Anyway, the drama that I would stir up, the martyrdom that I would stir up, but it gave me every excuse to drink. So our relationship was based on drinking, and it was volatile. It was just repeating the same pattern that my parents had. So he drank and smoked pot, drank more than I did things I didn't do. And so it was really, really easy for me to be like, I'm not that, right? And my dad, always the alcoholic in my life, drank at home. Well, I didn't do that. I was always out and about, and we'd go to, you know, these great beach bars and all this stuff. Anyway, for our time in our marriage, we did a ton of geographics, all the time. Like, his famous line was, everything will be better when. And I went right along with it. I'm like, yeah, everything will be better when. When we go here, when we go there, when we do this, when we do that. And we all know, everywhere you go, there you are. It just kept getting worse and worse. There was infidelity on both sides in our marriage. Again, stuff I probably wouldn't have done if I didn't have alcohol fueling a whole lot of it. We moved around a lot. We moved to Atlanta. We moved here in 98, stayed here until about 2006, and then we moved to D.C., stayed there for just a year, and then came back down here, bought another house, got a divorce, and I hightailed it back up to Charlottesville, Virginia, where my best friend lived. That was 2008, and I can say at that point, my drinking really, really took off. I mean, I had been a daily drinker since my 20s. Definitely when I was married, we were daily drinkers. And there were times I can remember, like my journal those journal entries where you start writing and the handwriting is horrible, and then I would take the pen and like rip the paper because I, you know, that kind of journaling. But there was one that was, yes, you can't really read it. Looks like an alien has taken your hand and started scribbling. But I kept one piece of a journal that says, I think I have to stop drinking, and I don't know if I can do it as long as I'm with him. I think this is our problem. But maybe if I stop, then at least I'll know that it's because of alcohol that we start fighting, and I can be responsible. I just couldn't do it. I mean, I hit him he had a bruised arm. He couldn't use it one day. I jumped out of a moving car. I mean, it was ridiculous, you know? I couldn't stop drinking with him. I couldn't stop drinking once we were divorced. So 2008 to 2013 was just a long, slow slide on my bottom. I sunk to lower lows than I ever had, continued just a rotating, revolving door of toxic relationships. I moved to D.C. for work. I do have a good story. Now that I'm being recorded, I don't know. I had an opportunity. I was very much like at my dad. On the outside, I looked buttoned up. I was all put together. I had become an executive assistant. Nobody like wakes up one morning and goes, I want to be an executive assistant. You just fall into it. It's like, oh, let me get treated like shit every day for my life. But I was good at it. Again, codependency. I'd work really hard, and it gave me a reason to drink. I interviewed for a very prominent family out on the West Coast, software development and foundational people. I was going to be on their personal assistant team for the wife. I was going to be second in command. They had one head of her personal assistants. She had 10 personal assistants, and I was going to be a person who manned her 24-hour hotline. I went through 14 interviews. Former CIA people are their security people. I had one final. I had gotten the offer. I was moving to Seattle. Amazing offer, penthouse suite overlooking the lake. I had one final like behavioral interview that I had to do. And I was living in Charlottesville. I drove to Reston, Virginia in the morning. The night before, everybody knows I'm about to move. So we're like, oh, let's go have a couple drinks. And I'm like, no, I really shouldn't. I have this interview tomorrow. They're like, no, come. I got drunk completely. Probably still drunk the next morning when I drove to Reston. Got there early, and I sat at a bar. I think it was like Tortilla Coast or something. I don't know. It was early. They had just opened, and I had a vodka and soda right before I'm going to do this behavioral interview, which is basically like part psychologist, part investigator, you know. So anyway, needless to say, best opportunity of my life, perhaps. It was what I had always wanted. If you were going to be an executive assistant, like, this is the pinnacle of anybody's career at that. And I drank it away, right? Like, it even talks about it in the big book. Needless to say, on April 1st, that was 2010, April Fool's Day, I got a call from my recruiter that says they've rescinded the offer. I mean, I had an offer in hand, and they said, and they won't tell me why. And they don't have to. It's not like the government, if you don't pass a security clearance, they tell you why. This family, they don't have to tell you anything. So I about lost my mind. I wasn't, you know, I'm pretty sure she knew I was an alcoholic when she started asking me some questions. Anyway, that was a sidebar, but just throwing away. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, truly. I think that job would have killed me. In the interview, I remember interviewing all the other assistants, and they kept saying, why do you want this job? We drink every night, crying every night. And I'm like, they're like, I'm like, how much do you drink? They're like, a bottle. I'm like, I got you. I do 2 bottles of wine a night. Like, I've got this. I can handle this. Anyway, so that didn't happen. So I was divorced, drinking like crazy, moved to D.C., again, got another, job with some crazy lunatic who gave me every excuse to drink and drink and drink. And I've now, resorted to, I don't drive, I only walk everywhere, which you can do pretty easily in D.C. I'd stop by the liquor store and get one of those box wines, because you can't really see how much you're drinking, and you're drinking a lot more because it holds a lot more. I got into another really toxic relationship, and but this one was different. He had all of the same isms, like the shady behavior. There always felt like he was like hiding something, but he didn't drink. He didn't drink a lot, and I didn't know. So I am a chameleon and would match my drinking to the people I was with. And he is the first person I ever had been with that didn't drink more than I did and hardly even drank. We would go to dinner and he'd have one glass of wine and he'd leave glass in the wine glass. And so I'd sit there and I'd maybe get 2 glasses of wine, but I'm dying. So for a year of being with him, I was losing my mind because I wasn't treating myself with my solution as much. I was literally losing my mind. And there was all kinds of drama with this. I found out later that he was married and he had been lying and told me he had an apartment, all this crazy stuff, which then, of course, just fueled my drinking more. But when I finally sort of slid to the bottom, again, I'm still pointing my finger at everyone else. I had gone to a colleague's house for a spring barbecue or whatever, and he was supposed to come and he didn't show, and it just gave me every reason to drink. And then these 2 married men that I work with hit on me that same night, and that pissed me off even more. I'm like, what is it that says across my face that I want to be somebody's mistress, So I just kept fueling. And anyway, long, big, drawn-out fight. I walk home freezing cold because the temperature had changed from warm to, and shattered my phone into a million pieces. Got home, woke up the next morning thinking, what in the hell happened? And remembering that I had this, I woke up saying, I can't do this anymore. It was kind of the, I had stepped so far away from God because I was raised Catholic and I was sent to the confessional when all that happened and, judged and condemned. But that moment I was like, whatever you are, I need help. And I had an appointment with this woman who a friend of mine told me I needed to see. And now I look back and she was probably like a spiritual healer. I wouldn't have believed in any of that had somebody told me that. But I had an appointment with her, and I totally forgot. But I had woken up that morning, and I'm like, I am not drinking anymore. I can't do this. And I went to see her, and we talked about all kinds of stuff. And then she said, okay, so what about your alcohol? And I'm like, I'm done. I'm done. She's like, okay. So we did a little, whatever, little spiritual woo-woo stuff over it. And that's my sobriety date, by some strange, crazy miracle. And that wasn't me. That totally wasn't me. I managed to stay sober for a few days without having meetings, without knowing. And the toxic relationship that I'm in, we're still back and forth trying to make this happen. All kinds of drama had happened and blown up. And I was like, you know what? I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. That's my problem. It's because of my dad and my mom. That's why I can't have successful relationships. I'm going to go to an adult child of alcoholics meeting. And I found one over at the National Cathedral, just north of Georgetown. It's like I can see the National Cathedral from my shower that had a cute little shelf where I used to like pour a big, huge glass of wine and drink it in the shower, by the way. I just looked at this church all the time. So anyway, so I'm on the phone with the toxic boyfriend, yelling, screaming, and I'm like, I have to go to this meeting. And I'm staring at the door, but not looking at the sign that's on the door that says ACOA this way, AA through these doors. But I'm too wrapped up in my drama. And I walk in the door, and it was a speaker meeting. It was a celebration meeting. And there's chairs. There's no tables. There's just chairs and chairs and chairs. And I sit at the back. But then people start coming in, and they're rolling out racks of chairs and racks of chairs, and I end up literally in the middle of this room. And I'm seeing all these, you know, women in front of me, like, chatting, and everybody's laughing, and there's, you know, all this great, like, fun and joy in this room. The guy gets up to the front. Oh, that's funny. Henry, these are his dogs. I didn't mean to have that right there, but he had 45 years of sobriety. Little old man shuffles up to the front, starts reading a preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, shit. I look back at the door, and it's like that movie scene where it stretches out, that, you know, gets really far away. I'm like, well, I can't leave because I'm in the middle of this room. And there was probably about 100 people there. So I just sit, shaking my legs. I see the guy across the aisle from me shaking his legs, so I'm sure he was pretty new too. But the two speakers, they had two speakers that day. It, again, this is my higher power working on me. The first woman was in her 60s, maybe early 70s. She was from France. Very classy, had nothing in common with me in any way, and yet her story was my story. As she talked about drinking a glass of wine and, you know, all cuddly with her boyfriend when she was young, and then a switch would flip, and then she would start getting very angry and very jealous, and her mood would just completely switch. I'm like, oh, that's me. That's me. So I heard my story that day, and I was like, okay, I got this. And then my other one, like, miracle, again, I didn't go to another meeting for a couple of days. I was sitting at a Barnes & Noble, and I had gotten a little journal, and I wrote in the front of it, this is the first day of the rest of your life. Very dramatic. And I was supposed to go to, like, Massage Envy or something early in the morning, and there was a water main break in D.C., and they called me. They're like, she can't make it. Can you come at 2? And I'm like, yeah, I'll just sit at Barnes & Noble. They call me again. They're like, she can't make it. Can you come at 4? Sure. And I'm still sitting there. And they're like, she can't make it. Can you come at 7 or 8? Something insane. And I am, like, going crazy. And there's a new wine bar right next door. And I'm like, I'm going to go drink. And I'm like, nope, I can't do that because my life is a mess. I can't do that. So I pull out my phone. I pull out Google Maps. And I type in AA. So I was in Bethesda at the time. I've gone back to that Barnes & Noble and tried to redo this. I can't get it to work at all. But I typed in AA, and it showed me where the Del Rey Club was in Bethesda, Maryland. And I saw that I could walk there in about 20 minutes. And so I walked. If I do that now, it sends me to, like, somewhere in Tacoma, Washington Airport or something. It's, like, crazy, other side of the world. So I go there, and I'm wandering around a parking lot because it's, like, behind a church. You know, it's one of those church meetings. It's just I'm, like, wandering around, and some guy is late because it was about 6:10, and he's like, are you looking for the AA meeting? And I was. And so he walked me into that meeting. And that was the meeting I stood up and said that I was an alcoholic. Old wood-paneled room, you know, the good old clubhouses. I met my first sponsor there. And I managed to stay sober by the grace of God. I say that, and I mean it, and yet it's not to say that people who can't stay sober or aren't staying sober don't have the grace of God. They do. I just, by the grace in me that is accepting a higher power, I've stayed sober. So I lost my job in sobriety, actually right around now. July 1st was my first day. They gave me like a little bit of time, and I had 3 months of severance, and I started going to a clubhouse at 7 a.m. in the morning. I started sobriety early in the morning. And I will tell you, I went to meetings 3 times a day, easily, in my first 9 months, probably more. I mean, sometimes 4. I was that crazy. I would call my sponsor, and she's like, go to a meeting. I'm like, I just went to a meeting. She said, go to a meeting. And I'd go to the meeting, and I'd come back, and about an hour later, I'd call her again, and she's like, go to a meeting. I'm like, I went to 2 meetings. She's like, go to another meeting. And it worked. It saved me. It absolutely saved me. And people just scooped me up and brought me into the middle of this, into this program. I did service early on. That same meeting, that first meeting that I went to, was every Wednesday night, friendship meeting, friendship group at St. Albans Church, at the National Cathedral. It still meets. They still do. Right now they're doing Zoom. But they did this raffle ticket, you know, somebody could win a book. Yeah, a big book or whatever. So I would. They sat me at the table and, like, take money for raffle tickets. You know, I would make coffee. I brought people, I drove people all over D.C., Maryland, Virginia, if they needed a ride to a meeting. I was in service all the time. But I didn't have a job. I made sobriety my job. And the first 4 months, I hadn't worked a single step. My sponsor was super busy, and I met this other woman on my belly button birthday in July. And I heard her speak, and I'm like, I need that. Whatever that is, I need that. And I brought her to coffee, and I asked her, you know, if she would be my sponsor. And we started working the steps together. And that's when the batshit crazy started to melt away. excuse me. So, you know, since then... I've had many jobs. I've lost jobs. I started a whole new career. I went through schooling and have done a million different certifications for coaching and leadership development. I call it, it's like sponsoring for people who aren't in AA. It allows me to be of service. I'm incredibly grateful for that. As an alcoholic, I don't think I do too well working for other people. There's a lot of us entrepreneurs out here. And my assistant sucks. That's me. And her boss is an asshole. That's me. But it's been an amazing, incredible journey. Like the promises, you know, the opposite of the bedevilments are the promises, and they have all come true. I have an incredible relationship, a healthy relationship with a loving, wonderful man who was going to be here, but instead we're taking care of his brother's kids. And I love him for that. You know, we are two whole people coming together to help lift each other up. We're not trying to make each other better. We're not, you know, trying to fill the gaps in each other. He's normal. He'll drink a glass of wine and leave this much in the glass and leave a bottle sitting on the counter until it turns to vinegar. I don't know. I don't understand that. But he is so supportive and loving and understanding, and you know, we have our moments, we have our disagreements, we have all of our stuff, but everything in the big book tells me what I'm supposed to do when I get into those moments. You know, we pause when agitated or doubtful, you know. I may not do it gracefully, but I'm like, I gotta go. I gotta go, but we'll come back, right? It's not that I gotta go and I'm gonna sweep it under the rug and I'm gonna drink it under the table and then we won't have to talk about it. So, yeah, the promises have definitely come through for me. And, you know, the thing, the line in the promises that to me is so incredibly powerful is we do not regret the past. We do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will see how our experience can benefit others. And it doesn't say some of the past, you know, and I hear a lot of people go, oh, you know, I still regret this and that. No, I can't have any of those regrets because then I'm not useful to somebody else if I'm not sharing all of it. And there's plenty of stuff still that I have that hurts at times. But one of the most powerful examples of that is I terminated some pregnancies in my drinking days. Again, nothing I ever would have thought I would have done. All I ever wanted to be was a mom. But that didn't happen. And I told one of my sponsees that one day, and she was like super goody two shoes. She had, bless her heart, she had still had her virginity like well into her 20s. And she called me years after I was living here, and she called to tell me that she was on her way to terminate pregnancy because she had just met this guy and she was sobbing hysterically, and she's like, I don't know what to do. I know you've been through this. What should I do? And I didn't tell her what to do. I used this program and I told her she's a beautiful, sober woman and she can make a sober decision that's right for her and she can make peace with it however she needs to. I didn't get that opportunity just because I drank all the way through it. And not that this is the right or the wrong decision, it doesn't matter, but she decided to keep that baby. And that little girl is 3 years old today. And she sends me pictures all the time to remind me that she wouldn't be here if I hadn't have shared that story with her. So I don't regret the past, as hard as it can be sometimes. Anyway, you all know that I've been through a kind of a fun family situation this year, but what it's reminded me so much is that, you know, this disease will take us to jails, institution, or death, one way or the other. And, you know, my brother's suicide has just been a catalyst to get me back into the center of this room, and especially this room. And you all have loved me and supported me through this and listened to me rant and rave and cry. And so for that, I am incredibly grateful. So thanks for letting me share.